My name's Steve Mitchell. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here. I swear, this is one of those things that always seems like such a good idea when somebody asks you to do it. There's always that time when you really wish they hadn't bothered. You know that ain't true, but it's a talking point. It really is good to be here. I've had a great time. John, congratulations. A long time without any Mad Dog wine. 6 years. I talked to another guy last night at the ice cream thing, said he was going to be here today celebrating 12 years. I don't see him. Alcoholics don't always do what say they're going to do. I mean, I don't want to hit you with anything too heavy in here today. But he said he'd be celebrating 12 years today and was going to be here this afternoon. But anyway, had some good conversations with people. I was in about a two-hour breakfast this morning with Francis and David and Tom joined us, and I guess what we did, we told a few lies, and every once in a while, somebody probably came close to the truth. But it really is true, what David said. We've known each other a long time, and we cut across all barriers here. This thing is so powerful that you just never know where this thing is going to settle down and what's going to happen when the power of Alcoholics Anonymous settles on someone's life. I walked down here with Dennis. I've always known Dennis since I've been in North Carolina, but I never heard him speak till recently. I think that you were in a tent the other night when I heard you, weren't you, Dennis? I believe he was in a tent last night. It's a worthless enough story. I don't know why I didn't think of this in Richmond the other night, but a guy I knew years ago, you talk about a few resentments, he said that they moved right next door to the minister and his wife, and this was a real fundamentalist church, and his wife got involved in this church, and this drunk told me, he said, that church ruined my life, Steve. He said, completely ruined my life, and he said, the greatest accomplishment, and the thing I'm the most proud of out of that, he said, before we moved out of there, I was able to sleep with the minister's wife. So you know this guy had a few resentments. But he said that they had a revival in that town, and they had it in a great big circus tent. And him and two other drunks got strategically around in different places around the block with axes and cut the ropes on that tent. And he said, we watched it come down. He said, Steve, those people thought the Lord come down on them. So I thought of that last night when Dennis was in there. I hope I can do as well. I don't think I can do as well in my talk as Dennis did in Arbutus this morning. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't compete here in what we do. But I hope in terms of my sincerity and my personal regard for Alcoholics Anonymous, my regard for you and my fellow man and for this program, I hope I can do as well. That'll be my goal this afternoon, to be honest and sincere. I tell you, I'm honored to be here. I don't take this lightly. I don't, one of the reasons I've stayed as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I have, because I found this is a good place to run a little green. This is a good place to run a little ignorant. I found that the smart ones don't stay here quite as long. So I didn't know this when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was no way for me to know this, but I was just right for Alcoholics Anonymous. This was in 1975. My sobriety date is May 26, 1975. I'm a member of the principals group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Raleigh. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been homeless for a protracted period of time. I was hemorrhaging blood. I'm dedicated to drinking. I ain't in here on moral grounds now. I'm dedicated to drinking. I've continued to drink with blood coming out both ends. In fact, is I don't mind telling you, if booze still did what it did for me in 1970, that's where I'd be right now. I'd be in one of them broken down country western bars. I'd have some half-dressed slingstress in there with me. She'd be telling me how good I am. She'd know it was a lie, and I would too, but it wouldn't make any difference. I can't imagine any reason to ever leave the bar if that stuff still worked. I mean, I believe very much that Alcoholics Anonymous is more powerful than alcoholism, but it's a close race. And the other thing is, Alcoholics Anonymous is slower. If somebody asked me what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was, I'd say it's a way of life that's slightly more powerful than the illness of alcoholism. If someone asked me what I thought alcoholism was, I would say, just for me, it means I can't live with drinking and I can't live without drinking. The very first time I heard someone describe that the majority of alcoholics who take their own life do it sober, nobody needed to describe that for me. I didn't need any edification with that. That made perfect sense to me. My best friend's going to be sober 26 years, and he always talks about the very first time that he heard the first step read out loud, that thing went off in his element like a rocket. It was indelibly etched in his mind. All of a sudden, it was crystal clear. This is what happened. This is why I went to prison. This is why I failed at everything all those years. And it, So I didn't, it made excellent sense to me, but I'm very dedicated to drinking, so I'm serious about drinking. I ain't against drinking today. I'm just against it for me. So I'm very glad to be here. Now it's gonna take me about 2 hours this afternoon, 2-3 hours to do what I'm gonna try to do. When I first got to North Carolina in 1989, a guy told me, he said, you never have to worry about being alone in Alcoholics Anonymous in North Carolina unless you talk 5 minutes after 9 at night. And I think there's probably something to that. I mean, none of us ever got sober on a Saturday night, and so told you that I'm a member of the principals group. It's I don't know if it's trendy. A lot of people say they're the member of the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world, and I don't know if I am or not. I just know it's the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I don't know if my sponsor is the best sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. I know he's just the best sponsor for me. My sponsor's been sober 2 years longer than I have, and he's fond of saying they taught things in that 2 years that they don't teach anymore. You know, and that's fine with me. You know, I sponsored a retarded man. I'm his guardian now. He's sober 21 years in April. April 20th, he's turned sober 21 years. He's still in Omaha. But he always used to think he could catch me. And I said, well, if you do, Harv, I'm in a lot of trouble. So, I always want to be around my fellows that are sober longer than me. And this has been such a profound thing in my life. It's been such a powerful way of life that my plan is to stay here one day at a time the rest of my life. They asked Dr. Bob, and I've had that on my mind a lot since I heard last week. I guess we've all heard last week about Dr. Bob's son dying. In my home group, we study history. I'm going to tell you about my home group, why I got it on my mind. It's a principals group. We're on 4400 Buffalo Road in Raleigh. We're right off of New Hope Road. We're one group that meets twice a week. On Tuesday night is our closed meeting. The first Tuesday night of the month, we study the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The chairman picks a topic out of AA literature, speaks on that, reads that topic, speaks on a little bit, and then calls on members to share their experience, strength, and hope. The second and third Tuesdays, we take topics out of Alcoholics Anonymous literature that are common for all alcoholics in their quest for sobriety. The fourth Tuesday night of the month, we do a tradition, so that we circle the traditions every year. I sobered up in a group that studied the traditions on Saturday nights, the only group I've ever heard of that done that. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that things are not always, or in life, that things are not always the way that they seem they are. People will say that the traditions are boring, or that they only have to do with this or that, or this is part of AA, and that's just not true. The traditions are alive and electric and profound and relevant, and they have tremendous application to my personal life. I used to go to a dentist. I hate going to the dentist, but I used to go to a dentist that I sponsored. And the reason I went to him is because I'm spiritual and I wanted to get a good deal on my bill. Now, I've always hated going to the dentist. He died in 2000. And since then, I've went to a lady dentist. And I found that it's an altogether different experience. Her office is alive, and little children run around in there, and they're encouraged to play. And I think last time I was there, the people who worked there had their kids in there. And it has a whole different feel. And you remember that rancid smell in dentists and doctors' offices when we were kids? There's none of that. It's real alive. And this lady pops off a lot. She says things like, I practice dentistry that doesn't hurt. I've been practicing dentistry for 20 years, and anybody that's practicing dentistry in this day and age that hurts people doesn't know what they're doing. I do root canals that don't hurt. I've been doing root canals for 20 years. My root canals don't hurt. She says all kinds of stuff like that. I guess it's like Dizzy Dean, the great baseball man and a philosopher, and I think drunk, what he'd say. But he said one time, if you can do something and you say it, it ain't bragging. And I guess that's the way Debbie was practicing dentistry. But anyway, I had a root canal from her, and it didn't hurt. You know, it's just a regular experience. I went back to work, and it's no big deal. I found the traditions to be quite the opposite of what so many people say. So we study them on the fourth Thursday night of the month, or Tuesday night. And if there's 4 or 5 months a year that have 5 Tuesday nights. And when there are, we study Alcoholics Anonymous history, believing that our collective history is as important to us as an organization as my individual history is to me individually. I was taught and believed that if I become for too long of a period of time what it was when I was drinking, that I'll sicken and drink again. And I don't want that to happen. And Bill Wilson said himself, if we ever fall apart, it'll be from the inside, not from the outside. We don't have anything to worry about from our friends. But I was talking to Chuck earlier. I've taken the history tour in Akron a couple times, and it's a moving experience. Dr. Bob has always been my man. I love the fact that he had all those tattoos all over him, and that he was always for the common man, and that he was such a bad drunk. And it's just such a moving experience to there are people in Akron at the central office who, as part of their service, if you call there, they'll take you around on the tour. And so, I've toured Dr. Bob's home and sat at the kitchen table, with the coffee pot there, and saw where Dr. Bob hid his bottles, and went to the Mayflower Hotel, which is an old people's home now. You're not supposed to go in there, but we waited till an elderly lady came out and told her what we were there for, and she said, "Well, go on in." And so we went in there. There was three or four of us, and we went in there. While we were in there, a fire alarm went off, and there was an Akron City policeman moving there, and he stopped us. Now, he was polite but businesslike. He wanted to know what we were doing in there, and we went to talking real fast. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We're here on the tour, and he said, "Oh, you want to see the phone, don't you?" But we went to the grave, Dr. Bob and Ann's grave, and the King School Group, the Gatehouse. The last living member just left out of here a week ago Thursday that was there when his dad, Dr. Bob, met Bill Wilson. It's a powerful thing to think about, and our history is gone. I heard his sister, Sue Windows, speak at the International Convention in San Diego in 95, and they're both gone now, but it's a powerful part of what we are, and so we study history on the fifth Tuesday night of the month, and then on Thursday night, we have our open speakers meeting, and speaker meetings, not being a speaker, but speaker meetings are my favorite meeting. I believe AA meetings are just one thing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're a profound part of what we do, but they're just one thing we do. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. Meetings are one thing we do. Now, they're profound and they're integral to our healing and to what we do, says in Alcoholics Anonymous literature, and I believe what it says in Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I only know of one thing in AA literature I don't believe. I don't believe that thing where it says that it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to become a normal drinker. I just soon watch the grass grow or get poked in the eye with a sharp stick or something as being a normal drinker. I mean, I don't have any desire to be a normal drinker. I can't imagine, wanting to be a normal drinker, what that would do for you. Now, I forgot what I was talking about before. This happens all the time. Doesn't have anything to do with getting older or brain damage. I'm used to it. The only time it embarrasses me is if nobody else is listening. And I can't get going. What was I talking about? I had something I was... Oh, speaker meetings. That's right. Thank you. Well, at least one person in here is listening. It is embarrassing if there ain't anybody can get you going. I think speaker meetings are the purest kind of actual Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that we have. Because we know that great things happen when one alcoholic talks and another alcoholic listens. It says in our literature that, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, but I've never heard an alcoholic yet that shared it with at any depth that didn't point their sobriety to other people. So while it is true, this seems to be the way God worked it out for us, that, we follow other people and this thing begins to move in our life. Well, I'm going to fast forward to the end, and I never know what's going to happen. When I get up here, I know what I'm going to try to do, and I know what I hope to do, but I never know exactly what's going to happen. My mind has always been one of those minds that kind of rocket fires, and I've never seemed very organized. I'm more organized in my mind than I am some other places. I can't even sort the mail and keep it straight. But I usually know what it is I want to do, whether that works out or not. Dennis told me on the way down here I look nice, and the only thing I could think of is that thing in the big book where it says visual proof is the weakest kind. I was at one of these things a while back, and Dick was there. I was at one of these things a while back, and a lady, a very attractive lady, stopped me outside the meeting room. It was on Sunday morning, and I was getting ready to go in. I was a Sunday morning speaker, and she said, "I'd like to say something to you if I could." And I said, "Well, sure, what is it?" You get a lot of comments, these things. And she said, "I don't know exactly how to say this," she said, "except this has been a good conference. Don't screw it up." All right. Well, I'm well aware of the fact that nobody can determine anybody's alcoholism for them. Everybody has to diagnose their own alcoholism. All right? We don't keep track of each other's time except as we get to know each other and get involved in a group and heal up on those things. But if I'm lying about how long I've been sober, the great guardian in Alcoholics Anonymous for an alcoholic in my description is booze. I'll sicken and drink. Nobody has to worry about kicking anybody out of here. The great guardian for an alcoholic is booze. So I'm well aware of the fact that nobody can decide on anybody else's alcoholism. I know that that's to be true. Now, I'm going to take a chance on saying that those people in Bill's Bar in Fremont, Nebraska were all alcoholics. That's where the miracle, and I think you could track it much further than that, but my direct run on Alcoholics Anonymous started right in Bill's Bar in late 1974. Now, Bill's Bar was a colorful place. I'm always struck in North Carolina by how few bars there are. I was sober 14 years when I moved to North Carolina, but there's hardly any bars in North Carolina. There's bars everywhere in Nebraska. I got sober in Chapter 5, about a block and a half or two blocks up Main Street from Bill's Bar, and Chapter 5, where I got sober, was right between two bars. Didn't make any difference. I wasn't allowed to go in either one anyway. But there are bars up and down both sides of the street. Bill bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. Now, at that time, you could have literally backed a farm truck up to Bill's Bar and put everybody in there and carted into Alcoholics Anonymous. You wouldn't have missed a person. You had to be drunk to stand it in there. The people who worked in there were drunk. We had colorful characters in there. We had a guy in there named Vibrator Hartman. Vibrator got drunk and burned up in a fire one New Year's Eve. We had a guy named Rodney Montaney. Rodney got drunk, got in a fight with a guy in a wheelchair and tipped him over. That ain't good. The way Rodney described that, he said, he hit me a good one, Steve, but I tipped him over before they got me out of there. And you know how people get loud when they get drunk? The drunker Rodney got, the quieter he got. Rodney'd get real drunk and his lips would move, but no words would come out of him. We had a guy named Leonard Larson. Now, Leonard had no neck. Leonard's head sat right on his shoulders, and he'd taken one too many shots to the head. But what Leonard would do is he would get drunk and crawl around on his hands and knees and lift bar stools to perform feats of strength. My fighting weight at that time was about 125 or 30 pounds. He used to have me jump off of bar stools onto his stomach to perform feats of strength. Now, Omaha, metropolitan Omaha, is a big city, and it's hilly. But most of Nebraska is flat. Big Red Football in Lincoln, that's a pretty good-sized town. But Nebraska is cattle and farm country. They got old laws on the books. Leonard went out in the country one day and shot a cow and stumbled out to a country road to help somebody get somebody to help him load it in his pickup truck and carted off. Leonard waved down an off-duty deputy sheriff. Got 1 to 2 years for that. We had a guy in a bar named Pee-wee Holtgren. Now, Pee-wee would get drunk, and Pee-wee was just dead weight. Wherever Pee-wee was at, he was just down. And the police would walk through there on Friday and Saturday night, and Pee-wee would be up on the bar sleeping. His head would be down. And what they would do, they had these big mirrors behind the bar, and somebody would just hold Pee-wee's head up like this, so when the police walked by, you could see his head in the mirror. And the police would get on the other side, they'd just drop him. Pee-wee didn't know it. His head would just bounce. And the two most colorful characters that came into Bill's Bar were two brothers named Billy and Tommy Walker. Now, I had gotten out of the military. I'd went off to the military in 1968. I'd gotten out of the military in 1972. And from the time I got out of the military in August of 1972 till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay in May of 1975, I only worked a period of 6 weeks, so you can imagine these were pretty lean years. But Billy and Tommy Walker came to town. I'm not long out of the military. And, you know, water always seeks its own level. I mean, they fell right into Bill's Bar. And I've always known things that I didn't know how I knew. Even today, I'll hear myself say something sometimes to a newcomer. So I'll say, I wonder, how do I know that? Now, I don't ever want to be in that thing of giving, like, trite one-liners or anything. But I'll hear myself say something, particularly of a spiritual matter. I say, how do I know that? Well, I knew when I was a little kid. I've always known things that I didn't know. When I was a little kid, I can remember to this day walking home from school, sometimes terrified. I would be just so, and if I had to describe what I thought the illness of alcoholism was, and I only had one word to describe it, I'd say it's fear. I'd just describe the illness and fear and think you could cut to the chase with that. But I can remember from as a little kid in grade school walking home from school and sometimes being terrified and being able sometimes to logically explain to myself that there wasn't anything to be afraid of. Now, if you can take logic and apply it to an emotional or a mental or a spiritual problem, and it doesn't get any better, then you've got a real dilemma on your hands. See, I didn't have any way of knowing that. There was no way for me to know that logic doesn't apply to what, it doesn't apply to fear, it doesn't apply to alcoholism, it doesn't apply to what we do here. But there was no way for me to know that. I didn't know that you had to change the inside for the outside to change. And I can remember being absolutely terrified. But I've always known things that I didn't know. My mom was explaining to me when I was a kid that things were okay. I knew that things were not okay. All the men on both sides of my family have always been horrible alcoholics. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholics. My dad just died a year ago at Christmas at age 80. Terrible case of alcoholism. I was probably sober 10 or 12 years, he said one time. He said, and with real consternation in his voice, he said, you know, I never have been able to figure out why Steve had so much trouble quitting drinking. He said, you know, I never did. Well, he'd never quit, you know. So it was that kind of a situation. But when I met Billy and Tommy Walker, This was in 1972, and I'm not long out of the military. The day I met Billy Walker, he told me he was just out of the 101st Airborne. Now, I knew that day that was a lie, and it's 30-some years later today. I know that was a lie. I knew it then. I know it today. Where Billy Walker was just out of was a penitentiary somewhere. No doubt in my mind. And when they came into town, they fell into Bill's bar, and I'm basically a beer drinker, but I'll drink anything. There was literally a time when I was a kid where I could drink beer for 24 or 30 hours, and I would be drunk, but I could remember stuff. I could talk to people. I could drive a car. I could comport myself with some kind of way of operating, but you let me take one drink of booze, one drink of straight whiskey, or one drink of wine with that stuff, and I never remembered what happened. You remember that deal about when you're a kid about drinking yourself sober? I never have known if that's true or not. I know everything in here they tell you ain't true. I've actually heard since I've been sober that the only way that you can sober up is through time. That's a lie. That is absolutely a lie. A guy named Cecil Woodgate put a .357 up to my head one night, and I have vague recollections of that experience of being drunk. I ain't going to tell you what I did to him. I don't think he should have. I don't think I needed to be shot, but he had a right to do something to me. But he put that .357 up to my head, and I have vague recollections of that of being very drunk, and he kept pushing it like that. And I remember asking him, I said, Cecil, is that thing loaded, or are you trying to scare me with it? And he hung it out the window and fired it. I sobered up some. And he was very capable of pulling the trigger. He was later killed during the commission of a burglary by a law enforcement officer. He was very capable of that. But I've always known things, and I knew that Billy Walker had not just got out of the military. I knew he had just got out of the penitentiary, but I started drinking with him. Now, I told you I'm a beer drinker, but I'll drink anything. So when I started drinking with him, Billy Walker drank dry gin and chased it with Squirt. I don't even know if they got Squirt here. I've never even seen it in North Carolina. But all it is a kind of soda. And his brother Tommy Walker drank bar whiskey and chased it with water. Well, when I started drinking with him, I started drinking that dry gin. And this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at that time. Now, there was a couple reasons I liked to drink with Billy and Tommy Walker. One reason I liked to drink with Billy Walker is I had a big mouth when I was drinking. Now, I was pretty safe in Bill's bar, but periodically we'd get drunk and wander off someplace else. And those other bars would call back up to Phyllis, and she'd send a drunk down to come and get us. But, you know, I had a big mouth. But I had another problem along with having a big mouth. I was a coward. Now, that's a bad combination to have. I don't see any reason that the same person should be afflicted with both of those things. It's kind of like today. I can't stand a mess, and I can't stand to clean a mess up. I don't think I'm too good to clean a mess up. It just doesn't work out. I've always wanted to live in one of those houses that looks like they ain't lived in. I had a girlfriend that kept her house that way one time. Now, she had a few other problems, I don't mind telling you. She had me, for one thing. But by the time I walk across the room one time, it doesn't look that way anymore. So I had a big mouth, but I was a coward. Now, at Billy Walker's biggest, I went up a pant size a year when I got sober. I needed to. But at Billy Walker's biggest, he was never any bigger than I am right now. But he would attack people. He looked like that dog on the Greyhound bus. He would just fly on people. And the other reason I like to drink with Billy Walker, there just ain't any other way to explain this. I've searched for some other way to explain it. As far as I know, there is none. Billy Walker, I've seen a lot of people. I've seen a lot of men that could get a lot of women. But I've only seen a couple, three of them that seemed to me to attract women. And Billy Walker was one of them people. And my game plan at that time was I'm going to hang out right here with old Billy Walker and possibly get in on some of the overflow. Now, well, when I started drinking with Billy Walker, this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at that time. And that country music would go all the time in Bill's bar. Even today, I question people's alcoholism that don't listen to country music. You know, I mean, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you'd have that didn't listen to country music. I mean, they might not even be alcoholics. If they're in here and don't listen to country music, they might be heavy drinkers or some other aberration. But when I started drinking with Billy Walker, this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at this time. Billy Walker told me, I started drinking that dry gin, and he said, this is how you have to drink that. He said, what you do, he said, when you get the gin, he said, you get the gin in a shot glass, and you order the squirt in a setup glass, small, it's about like this coffee cup, only smaller. But he said, what you do is you drink the gin down real fast, and when you drink it down, never breathe. And the reason you don't ever want to breathe, he said, that gin is nasty, and if you smell it, it can make you gag. And I said, well, all right. So he said, what you do is you take the gin, drink it down, and then drink the squirt down real fast. That's how you drink it. I said, all right, Billy, that's fine. Makes sense to me. He said, the other thing you got to do, he says, is begin to use a lot of pepper on your food. Now, we weren't eating much in those days anyway. And I said, well, what will that do? And he said, well, he said, the truth of the matter is, he said, this gin has been known to hurt your liver. And he said, pepper will counteract any liver damage. Now, that's the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at that time. I'm looking for him because if he's living, He's either locked up or in here. That was the choices he had. And, I mean, the choices I had. So if, my goodness. You know, and it also talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous literature, it says that the drinking history of any alcoholic, it says something to the effect that that there's some hilarious stuff happens and there's some tragic stuff happens and there's all kinds of stuff in between. There's lots of, you know, there's some terrible stuff that happened with my drinking. I came back from Vietnam in January of 1971, and my alcoholism had progressed to the point. Now, you know, it's bad enough that the drinking progresses, but other stuff progresses with it, too. The fear progresses, the hatred progresses, the isolation, the blaming of other people. And so because of my alcoholism, I suppose, and because of the hatred and because of the way I was living, I was responsible, at least partially responsible, for the death of another person. Now, I don't think it would be right to say that it didn't bother me, but I think what happened from that time is that my drinking went into another zone. I think I moved to another thing, and I learned years later through the process of inventory and through the healing grace of these steps is that, as sick as it is to say this, is that I really thought that person deserved what they got for what they did. And what happened is my life just kind of went on from that. And it went on in a different way, where parts of me were just shredded, and it just went on. There's fallout from that kind of stuff. I mean, it's one of the things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, because anybody learns here that you practice these principles for a while, is you can't give anything away in life. Whatever you send out comes back. It always comes back to us. I mean, that's the good news. The good news is I don't have to help anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only have to try to help them. I get the same benefit out of helping somebody. I made a 12-step call. Another guy and I made a 12-step call on a guy. I'd been sober about 6 months. I gave him his last drink. He was too drunk to get off the floor. He either asked for gin and I gave him vodka, or he asked for vodka and I gave him gin. He couldn't get off the floor, but he wasn't too drunk to know I'd give him the wrong kind of booze. I gave him his last drink. I also worked with a guy. I sponsored a guy one time for 7 years. I gave him his chip every year for 7 years, and after he'd been sober 7 years, this was in Omaha, he took the buyout with Union Pacific Railroad, and they moved him to Kansas City, or St. Louis it was, for an excellent job, and those guys were getting like $15,000 plus their salary just to move. And Jeff never really reestablished with Alcoholics Anonymous, like with a lot of people. He didn't quit going to meetings, but he never really established. He didn't keep in touch with me. He didn't get a sponsor. He didn't get a home group. And he just kind of floated around off and on, was out of sorts. And about a year later, he started drinking. And about a year after that, he took his own life. But, you know, if it is true that we can't get anybody or keep anybody sober, that's both the good and the bad news, isn't it? But I get the same benefit from trying to help somebody that I get from actually helping somebody. So, you know, all kinds of things happened through my drinking, and I think I was shredded from that and went on and just whatever was there. I don't think I was ever very good before I started drinking. I grew up in alcoholism, and I'm not part of that breed that wants to pull other people under my tent. I took responsibility for my alcoholism. The people who raised me in Nebraska is textbook. In very many ways, it's like part of the country of North Carolina. They have a wonderful work ethic in Nebraska. Those farmers, I never grew up on a farm, but I was in farm community. I lived in a town of about 25,000 people outside of Omaha, and they have a work ethic that's second to none. They understand shared purpose. They understand hard work. They understand honesty. Now, those same people, my grandfather, who was an alcoholic, wouldn't go fishing on his own property without a fishing license. You know, they have a sense. It's a kind of honesty. If you went in the grocery store and bought a carton of cigarettes with a $50 bill and they gave you back change for $100, they'd give the change back. Now, I was introduced to all of that. I was never afflicted with any of it. I mean, I knew about it. None of it ever took on me. But it was that kind of honesty. Now, those same people, however, would stay right out there and drink themselves to death. You know, that same kind of honesty just doesn't work. It's not this kind of honesty that we need at a cellular level to deal with the illness of alcoholism. You're not going to reverse a killer illness like this by coming in here and talking about your problem. It takes what the book says about depth and weight. It takes real power to reverse a killer illness like alcoholism. But funny, some hilarious stuff happened with my drinking, too. I mean, some stuff that's absolutely, I mean, you could never, what's that old thing about truth is stranger than fiction? I mean, some of the stuff you could never make happen. It just happened. I left the bar one time in the wrong car. I drove a car to the bar that was white, and I got out of the car, and apparently, I mean, unknowns to me, I found out all later, I left the keys in the car, went in the bar, and sometime later left the bar, got in a white car, a fluke, the keys were in it, drove off in it. Now, the only bad problem was the car I drove to the bar, I left that. I had this woman with me, and I don't want to be, I hope I won't be disregarding anywhere, certainly not from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I hope I won't be disrespectful anywhere. There wasn't anything wrong with this woman. She wasn't ugly or anything. She was old. And apparently people in the bar saw us leave. Now, about 2:30 that morning, I was arrested for drunk driving and auto theft. It took me quite a while to figure out what had happened. They put this woman and I in the same jail cell together. This was out in Washington State, out in the country, in this little country town. They put us in the same jail cell.
And this highway patrolman, this little night marshal, went to work on trying to figure out what had happened. And eventually they got it figured out. Now, that morning, they let us out. Now, I've told this story so many times. You know how you can't remember if something actually happened or you just think it happened? You told. Now, this story is true, but I actually think they even gave us the beer back. But I never will forget, if I live to be 1,000 years old, that morning when they let us out. That patrolman let us out. And this woman I had with me, like I said, she was old. And I told this story one night in Decatur, Alabama, and a lady right down the front row said, "You mean the tour?" I said, no, I don't. I wish I did. I mean old. And she had on these shorts that about half of her butt was coming out the bottom of those shorts, and it was rough. And I never will forget, though, that morning when they let us out of jail, the patrolman was standing outside, and the patrolman was poking me in the chest like this and saying, "She has to drive. You're too drunk to drive. She has to drive." And was poking me in the chest. And as I started to walk off that morning, we were walking off to the car, I get about maybe halfway from this podium to the back of the room, and I turned around and saw that patrolman, and our eyes locked. Just like, you know how that'll happen? They're just like they were glued together. And he went like this. He went. You know, I mean, I didn't have any way of telling him that, but I said, if I would have, my answer to that would have been my sentiments exactly. You know, that was rough. I had a married girlfriend one time, and I had her hidden out from the law and her husband. And a buddy of mine got married, and Mary Lou, a good Catholic name from Nebraska. People in Nebraska are Catholics about like people in North Carolina are Baptists. But Mary Lou and I were the best man and best woman at the wedding, this married girlfriend and I. And I had on the only pair of cowboy boots I'd ever owned in my life, and the toes turned up like this. So we stood up with them up at the courthouse while they got married, and things went so well, we just went on the honeymoon with them. And Mary Lou was writing bad checks as we went around. And our idea was, as we were going to toast their marriage, we were going to go to Miami. Now, this is in Fremont, Nebraska, and as the day went on, we're getting drunker and drunker, and so we decided we'd go to Denver. That's about half as far as Miami, and we ended up that night in Omaha. But, you know, there's a story in my life. I was hitchhiking one time, you know, and there's places in our literature. You'll hear in these meetings about how smart alcoholics are. I guarantee you, you'll never hear anything like that from anybody who lives with us. But there's places in our literature that seem to flirt with that. There's a place in there that it says the alcoholic is usually bright. I'm paraphrasing or something, but I can't be literal. But it says something to the effect about the alcoholic is usually bright and builds up his family and then pulls them down. I'm hitchhiking one time from Fremont, Nebraska to San Gabriel, California. And I had a drunken uncle who, when he quit school when he was a kid and went in the Army, became a paratrooper. And when he got out of the Army, he didn't have any education. And he went to California and he literally got wealthy. And the time I'd been out there before, he was living up in Glendora and had a swimming pool in his house and wife and kids and everything was going fine. Well, he had lost all that by the time I got out there. But anyway, I'm hitchhiking. People in Nebraska, in my part of the country, moved to California to start their life over. I probably made my first trip to California. I know I made my first trip to spend the summer there when I was 14, but I quit high school when I was in probably 11th or 12th grade and hitchhiked to California to start my life over. People are doing that, I guarantee you. If you go to Nebraska today, people are somewhere out there on Interstate 80 headed to California. Start their life over. The problem always was for me. I woke up in California and there I was. You know, nothing had changed. I hadn't been here. There was no way for me to know that when you change the inside, the outside automatically manifests. You know, I don't have to do anything. There used to be a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just ran into him recently. I don't think he says this anymore. But I used to hang on this at some of the darkest times in my life. This guy used to say all the time in his talks, "You don't have to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous except practice these principles to the best of your ability, and anything that's necessary for your fulfillment will automatically be added to it. You don't have to do anything else. You don't have to do anything about whatever's hindering or harming your fulfillment in life. It'll automatically be removed. The only requirement necessary to practice these principles to the best of your ability, that things move in and happen when you do that." But anyway, I was a long ways from that at this time. I'm out of the military, and I had written a bunch of bad checks. Now, Phyllis, who was the kind of the matriarch of Bill's bar, Phyllis took care of things. Like I said, Bill had made his fortune in the garbage and septic tank business. And he bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. Well, Phyllis had a series of what she called pets. And I was one of them. Now, Phyllis, they've been in the bar business a long time. If Phyllis herself shut you off, you never got a drink in their bars again. If any of the help shut you off, you could go to Phyllis and she would turn you back on so you could drink in there. But Phyllis had paid off a bunch of bad checks for me, but she had got sick of that and wouldn't pay off anymore, so I was hitchhiking to California. I got to a little America, Wyoming, on my way to San Gabriel, California, and a guy picked me up and took me to Portland, Oregon, and dropped me off. Now, you can imagine my shock when I got off in Portland and found out I was further away from San Gabriel than where he got me. And again, those things happen time after time after time. I have no difficulty in understanding why I stayed with drinking so long. Drinking was it I was looking for my entire life. Alcohol was absolutely magic in my life. When I can track my active alcoholism from age 15 to almost age 26 when I quit drinking. And it's so easy now to see that. But I suppose I was a bright enough kid. I was a normal enough child. I was probably a little bit retarded emotionally, having come along in alcoholism. But I was a deeply troubled child. And one year in grade school, I'd get A's and B's. The next year, I'd get D's and F's. I hadn't even started to drink yet. I mean, obviously, I was in trouble. But as a 15-year-old kid, I suppose I was a good athlete, but I had three things come over me at one time. It's a death sentence as far as sports. I quit growing, I got a bad attitude, and I started drinking. Now, you might weather one of those. You ain't going to weather all three of them. But I started drinking as a 15-year-old kid, and booze was so magical. I watched my daughters, they're grown women now, go through that awkward kind of thing of learning how to do stuff and learning how to date. And I'd made a few runs past those little neighborhood kids, and I was interested. But I wasn't sophisticated enough to know that other boys were lying when they said what they were doing with girls. I didn't know any of that, but I got a job at a place called the Pathfinder Hotel. I was a bellboy there, and I was introduced to the ways of the world there. That's like putting a hog in a corn patch. I mean, there's absolutely no shock to me why, you know, booze did so much for me. There was no way I could have went up to a 15-year-old girl, a classmate of mine, and asked to go to the movies. I was interested in those things. I just couldn't have done it. It was impossible. Like that time in Nebraska, they were selling 3 quarts of beer for a dollar. We used to buy those quarts of beer by the case. I'd drink a couple, three of those quarts of beer and go down where the girls were. Now, this is the way it seemed like it happened. It seemed like I would drink those 2 or 3 quarts of beer and go down there, and they would get you. You don't give up something very easy that takes you from over here to lock. You're on lockjaw over here. You might as well be mute. You're just locked up. You drink 3 quarts of beer, and you turn into an orca. Now, you don't give up something that does that much. I mean, you just don't. I mean, it's just the most magical thing. So it just sort of took off from there, and I went into the military. I was barely old enough to get in there. A dishonest recruiter got me in there. I paid him $65, and I think he got cheated. And he told me that I wouldn't be able to get in because I'd been arrested so many times. Just minor stuff like, you know, public intoxication and trespassing and minor in possession. But I went off into the military, and this was in 1968, and my goodness. You'd really have to question. I can't fix anything. I figured it was a major deal when I learned how to work the self-service pumps at the gas station. I can't fix anything. If I get a flat tire, I'm just down until you get there. Now, you can imagine my shock when I get out of basic training in the military and they send me to Wichita Falls, Texas to work on airplanes. You know, I've had 2 razors in my life and maybe 3. I can't be sure that I'd actually thrown away because I couldn't figure out how to get the blade in that thing. You know, and so my military career went downhill in a hurry. And in the Air Force, they always threaten you that if you don't do what they tell you to do as far as your schools, they'll turn you into a cook or a cop. And that's what happened to me. I got kicked out of that school and they sent me to the state of Arkansas. And from there, I went to Vietnam. And you know, the military didn't have anything to do with my alcoholism except it speeded it up a little bit. It provided a perfect place for it to breed itself. But anyway, by the time I got out of the military, I was in bed.
It's hard to quantify pain. It's hard to get a hold of it. Time is like that. I go home at night sometimes from work. I can't hardly remember the morning because it seems so long ago. But the last year can be a blur. And I was so sick during this time. Now, what happened is Libby made this great, big, beautiful Thanksgiving dinner, and she had her kids in, and I wasn't able to eat. I'm sick now. I'm that kind of sick where I remember stuff, but I can't be sure if it really happened. I don't know if I saw somebody or if I just think I saw them. I wake up, I'm freezing, but I'm drenching in my own sweat. I'm seeing and hearing things, and Libby's buying quarts of beer for me to sip on. I'm that kind of sick now where I get a little bit to stay down, I think I'm going to get well, and then I get sick again. And it goes over and over like that, and of course I'm not able to eat. Libby had a talk with me that went very much like this. I don't remember most of it, but what I do remember is so clear. She said, I've been around alcoholics all my life. She said, I've been married to 2 alcoholics. And you got to remember now, Libby herself was permanent party in Billsboro. But she said, I don't think I've ever seen anything like you at your age. She said, there's a man in town who helped my last ex-husband. He's now been sober a full year. He's got a job. He's paying his child support, and he's doing very well. If you want me to, I'll call him. Now, for a long time, I'd wanted a way out. You can get fairly spiritual in Nebraska when it's freezing out and you don't have any place to go. But on the other hand, I'd wanted a way out for a long time. Depending on when you caught me, it might have looked like I knew everything in the world except how to shut my own mouth and how to quit drinking. It might have looked like that. Or it might have looked like the way it really was. I didn't have enough dignity to hold my head up. I mean, I was in some desperate straits. I'd had a couple, three plans on how I was going to get out of this. One plan, I didn't have very good insight, but even I knew this plan probably wasn't going to work. I had a plan to marry a rich woman. I could see as the way things were going, you know, that may not happen. I had another plan to get a job. The way things were going, that was not going to happen. And the plan that stuck in my mind most of the time was I was going to kill myself. And I would play my funeral over and over in my mind as that country music would blare on the jukebox.
And I would see myself at that funeral in the casket and people going by, and I'd say to myself, they could have done something about this. You know, they had a chance. They could have done something about this. But anyway, long story short, Libby called Bob Brannigan, and the last day of November of 1974, he made the first call that was ever made on me, and he spent, I understand now, most all that Saturday afternoon with me. I only remember a couple things from that. I remember asking him the question, how do you get the willpower to not drink? I remember what he said. He said, I look on willpower a little bit different than you do. He said, what I think willpower is the way you take that drink knowing it's going to come back up. That's what I think willpower is. I remember asking him, how long since you've drank? And he said, if I can make it till September, it'll be 11 years. Well, whatever that is, from now, he's still sober. So I guess it's, what, 40 years now almost. He carted me off to the state hospital the next day and a little ways. It was about 120 or 30 miles away. And he bought me a carton of Marlboro cigarettes. I was smoking at that time, of course. And he bought me a can of 7-Up. I had horrible cramps. And I gave him that great line that I don't know how many times I must have said when I was drinking. When he bought me that carton of cigarettes and that can of pop, I said, I'll pay you back. And what he did is, I remember the way he was driving his car and everything. He looked over at me and he said, that ain't the way this works. You'll be expected to help someone else when you're able. That's what I'd like to think I've been doing. I actually got sober Memorial Day weekend. That was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober Memorial Day weekend out of my sister and brother-in-law's farm. I'm about 3 days without a drink, and I ain't much on animals on a good day. I mean, I was in a parking lot one time and a guy had a horse and asked me to hold the horse. I said, I ain't holding the horse. And he said, hold the horse. I said, I ain't holding the horse. He said, hold the horse. I need help. I said, I can see that, but I ain't holding the horse. And he had the horse on a leash or whatever it is. He said, hold the horse. He said, the horse ain't going to hurt you. I said, how do you know what that horse is going to do? The Titanic went down. I ain't holding the horse. But anyway, my sister tells to this day that I get every time I go back to Nebraska about once a year, every 2 years, they talk about this. And they're not alcoholics, but I guess if you live through this, you never forget. My sister said I woke him up in the middle of the night. I'm about 3 days without a drink, and said that the animals were after me and I was hearing noises. And she got up in the night and took me into town. They called people from Alcoholics Anonymous who put me in a motel room. And that was my introduction. That was my real, real introduction from that time on. Of course, I'm crazy in there, but I had a decision come to me in there. The first step of Alcoholics Anonymous moved in my life in that motel room. You know, the first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. That thing moved in my life, and what happened in that motel room is I made a decision. If I got out of there alive, I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous and I would really try. You know, that step says that I can't live with drinking and I can't live without drinking. I was never, you know, I guess this is both blessing and curse too. I always knew that not drinking was not going to be an answer for me. I always knew that. I'm dry about 7 days, and my great aunt asked me if I'd like to come and live with her. This was in 1975. She was 75 years old. If she were a young woman today, she'd be an attorney or a professor. She spoke 3 languages fluently, and she was a lifelong student of Latin. I'm given to understand you don't speak Latin. You study Latin to understand words, and her deal was words and word derivative and where they came from. And she asked me if I'd like to come and live with her, and she had just lost her husband of 50 years, my great uncle. She said, I have someone in mind who will take you to Alcoholics Anonymous if you will go. You know, almost all alcoholics, it's not as bad as it used to be in AA, but we need to be awfully careful how we talk about the non-alcoholic. I would not be alive if it were not for non-alcoholics. I don't know many alcoholics who would. Even a casual snapshot observation of AA history is clear. We'd have never got AA going. We're served to this day on our General Service Board by non-alcoholics, and you know, I personally count Dr. Silkworth and Sister Ignatia and Ann and Lois and Dr. Silkworth as equal founders. You know, and if you look at what the Rockefellers did with us in terms of our corporate poverty, the day that they told us they wouldn't give us any money, the tax laws hadn't been changed at that time. They were paying millions more than they do today in taxes, and they could have thrown that at us. Wouldn't have meant any more in pocket change to them. But anyway, my great aunt, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And the very first summer that I was sober, I couldn't have put this in words, but I knew something had happened. I was as terrified as I ever was. I mean, nothing had changed in that respect. But I was slightly different. And what I know today is the second step had started to take place in my life. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. What had happened is, the byproduct of that step for me was hope. I started to have some hope. I listened to people, and there are still people today from that time that I'm still listening to, but I still understand that step to have a great deal to do with people. I understand that God moves in, you know, I've never found anybody that trusted God that didn't trust God's children, so that thing started to move through God's people, and I started to
you know, I was going to meetings, and I still understand the second step is meetings and Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I was learning during that time to never let a day go by that I don't read AA literature, and I've been doing that all these years. I read it this morning. See, what I really think Alcoholics Anonymous is, it's a way of life made up of a series of a great many parts of a whole. Meetings are a fundamental part of that. It says in the 12 and 12, most of us can't recover without the group, but meetings are just one thing that we do. Our precursors to this thing, the Oxford group, meetings weren't even a requirement. They were a suggestion. There were a number of other things they felt like was more important. But I think at the pinnacle of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the 12 steps, and then sponsorship, and then I have to get surrendered to the idea that I'm here to be of service to my fellows, and so, and Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I think it's made up of many parts of a great whole. I believe very much what Dr. Bob said. They asked Dr. Bob one time if he thought he'd ever drink again. And he said, I don't think I'll ever drink again as long as I live one day at a time unless I quit doing what I've been doing right up to this moment. See, if any alcoholic could put all the jets of Alcoholics Anonymous in place at one time and still drink alcohol, then you'd have no miracle here. What you would have here would be a crapshoot. It's quite the opposite. So I went on in the steps. The first summer I was sober, I did the third step on my knees with my sponsor. But I know today that what I really did was I turned my will and my life over to the care of my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I did. I wouldn't have turned my will and my life over to the God that I understood because I blamed God for the direction my life had taken. I've never met an alcoholic who came here that wasn't in deep spiritual distress. I don't know how you could get in here without being in deep spiritual distress. It's a spiritual illness. And the spiritual confusion is incredible. One of the things the great psychiatrist Carl Jung said in that correspondence with Bill Wilson, he said that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol is similar to man's thirst for God on a lower level. So that's a pretty powerful thing. And that statement that Bill Wilson made about the alcoholic more than most seems to want to know what it's all about. I always have wanted to know what it's all about. So my sponsor explained to me that my will was my thinking and my life was my action. So if I turned my will and my life over, what I needed to start to do was to live responsibly. And my thinking could be counted on to follow that. So I was told to try to do the right thing. I went to meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, every day. I read AA literature every day. A guy that got off work with me, he got off work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He sobered up the same month I did. We had the same sponsor. 1975, I gave him the name Big Harold because he's almost 6 foot tall and he weighed 115 pounds. He looked like a prisoner of war. Now, I don't know what I must have looked like at that time, but he told me later, the first time I saw you, I told my wife, there's one that's really hurting. But every day at 3 o'clock, he would get off work and come over to my great aunt's and we would stay over there and drink coffee until the meeting. Then we would go to the meeting. Then we would go out with our sponsor and other people. So it was a wonderful time and place to sober up. If you really wanted to sober up with those people, you'd have to be brain dead to miss it. It's been my experience here to follow men and women that are absolutely spiritual giants, not in terms of their godliness, but in terms of their commitment to this program, that not only drinking would not happen, it was impossible to happen if you applied these things, if you did these things. So I went on in the steps. I did the inventory, and I look back on it now, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. My first fourth step, what I really did is I got down all the nasty stuff on paper. That's what I really did. It was everything that I thought separated me from everybody that was decent. There was a great deal of stuff about resentments. There was a tremendous amount of stuff on there about fear, and there was a tremendous amount about sex. And I told you, I had some horrible stuff to try to get through on that thing. I mean, I had the death of another person. And there was horrible stuff to try to get through. So I did it according to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took my first sober fifth step with a Catholic priest that was a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, it was perfect. You know, you talk about self-centeredness. That's, you know, the step says admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I didn't have any interest in being Catholic at that time, but I had it in my head that a priest couldn't tell. You know, and I've heard my share of fifth steps. I've never had any desire to tell anything I heard in there. But my experience, just my experience, and any AA speaker should say that, you know, I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm nothing. I'm just a guy that this thing has worked awfully well for. So, you know, but I don't know if this is everybody's experience or not, but my experience as a listener in fifth steps is 90% of what people plan to take to the grave with them has to do with sex. You know, and I had plenty of stuff on there about that, but I had one thing on there that didn't have anything to do with sex. It didn't have anything to do with anything, but it was bigger than life to me. And the reason I tell you that is until I got it down on paper and got it into God and another human being, it just owned me. And it didn't have, I look on it now, it wasn't even in the top 30 worst things I've ever done. It didn't have anything to do with anything. But it just separated me until I understood it, until I got it to another person. My listener in the fifth step told me to meet him at the rectory at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, and for me it was perfect. I got up there at 9:10, and he answered the door. He said, "I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic." He had on those great big black pants. If it would have got cold, I could have got in there with him. Those things were so big. And he had on those big shoes that people's feet hurt, you know, the big soles. And he had his chewing tobacco right in his pocket. He told me to be prepared for a long talk like the book says, and I was. I left there at 12 o'clock noon different. Now, one of the things that happened to me as you know, I was even able to identify it at the time, and it's the same thing I hope happens to anybody that I work with. There was two things that were real awarenesses to me when I was done with that. One thing is I was aware of the fact I had come a considerable distance. I don't think anybody's going to do an honest and fearless moral inventory with God themselves and another human being unless they believe their life depends on it. So it was obvious to me I had come a considerable distance. The other thing apparent to me is that would be a horrible place to pull out. It looks like to me, and again, take this for what it's worth, it might not even be right, but this looks like to me this is where we begin to start to lose our members is after the fifth step. That the least talked about steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, an absolute difference between a rocket and a dud firecracker, is the sixth and seventh steps. But for me, it's a profound place in terms, it looks like to me, if you don't have good leadership when you get to this place in the program, it looks like filler material. What happened to me at the sixth step is the sixth step started to become for my life like the first step was to my drinking. And I anchored down. You know, the sixth step says we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And the seventh step says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Things happened there that I think what happened is I became an established member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I anchored down there. I took my place as a recovered alcoholic. I'm not going to just walk off and get drunk. Could I get drunk? Of course I could get drunk. Any alcoholic. But my experience is, after people have been here and had the experiences of the steps and have been anchored here, I've got to pull away. It happened for me. Again, we usually don't talk about it in these terms. But when I was sober about 18 months, it became apparent to me that I wouldn't have to drink again one day at a time unless I demanded to. I've never had an alcoholic that didn't share that at a cellular level. I could get drunk, of course I could, but I'd have to demand a drink. I'd have to pull outside of the protection. So the sixth and step were incredibly healing for me, and I like to be very literal about those steps. Anything I've ever tried to work on has gotten worse. You know, I think what I have to do is become willing, I have to ask, and then I have to cooperate. The eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. For me, making the list and becoming willing, if I've done all the damage, becoming willing is not a problem. Where I have trouble being willing is where there's been spiritual warfare, when I feel like I've been damaged. We say in Alcoholics Anonymous, or we say in life, that we can't change the past. My experience with that is that's only a half-truth. When I get around the eighth and ninth step, the past starts to shift. I've actually made appointments to go to amends with people I owed amends, and I've left there, and they physically look like a different being. They just look like a whole different person. My understanding of the past has shifted the longer I've stayed sober. The ninth step says that we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I've had wonderful experiences with those steps. I mean, I've had incredible things happen with those steps. I heard a guy say one time, and it's certainly been true for me, he said, if you can get to the bottom of the ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous, what you got right there is a jet engine for life. Because you're just operating out there in the power right now. My two biggest problems in life have always been the past or the future. If I get the past cleared away with, I get current with the power right now, I'm just operating. I believe I'm at my best when I'm natural. It's kind of like giving a talk. If I forget I'm here, the talk just happens. I'm a baseball fan. The big unit, Randy Johnson's my man. He brings the ball at about 100 miles an hour. He throws his fastball at 98 point something. He's about the best baseball's got, and he'd be glad to tell you that sometimes when he gets in trouble, even today, even though he's a Cy Young winner, I guess, I think he is, that even though he knows better, he'll try to aim the ball. And even though he knows he can't aim the ball, you just have to bring it. If I've ever gotten hooked to any principle that's been all by itself, powerful and healing and profound, it's been living in the power right now. And at the bottom of the ninth step, that's very true. You just got a jet engine for life. You're just operating and just hooked to this thing. Tenth step says continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That's a walking around step for me. That makes it possible for me to live. And now sometimes I have been prompt no matter how long it's taken. But I try to stay current with that so that I know what's going on and deal with each day in its march. When I was new and I looked at the 11th step, that seemed so ominous and so mystical. You know, the step says that sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, to me, that step is very practical. What we're doing here this weekend fits very well within the 11th step. I think God's will for me. I spent my entire life wondering why I was here. You know, that thing I said about Bill Wilson once said that an alcoholic more than most wants to know what it's all about. I know exactly what my job in life is. My job in life is to practice these principles to the best of my ability and carry the message. And I think that step gives me tremendous clarity for living. I got one wife, so I sleep with one woman. I see a lot of good-looking women. I ain't forgot about it. It's just that, you know, it just wouldn't work. I don't have any other way of getting money, so I got to work for it. I think the step is pretty clear about that. There's big money in my family on both sides. I don't ever have to worry about any of it coming to me. I got a, I mean, the only way I got to get any money is going to work every day. I got a great aunt and uncle who have their name on a building at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, the planetarium. You got to give several $1 million to get your name on one of those buildings. But I don't ever have to worry about it. So the only way I got to get any money is going to work. I think I can be fairly safe on the natural virtues of life, of kindness, of fellowship with my fellow man, of trying to be helpful to God's children, to do what I'm supposed to do. And then I think that's the 11th step for me. I think it's all very clear. It's not confusing anymore. When I was sober 20 years, it finally became apparent to me that I'd done the best I could do drinking, and I'd done the best I could do sober. And that these principles are my way out. I guess that you could say that the booze was the it I was looking for all my life, and then you could say that after the booze, this was it. 12 steps is having had a spiritual awakening. As the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I had a lady that was an English teacher many years ago ask me, well, this is just, again, for me now, what I believe about the 12 steps is they're all of equal importance. I think AA literature supports that. The only thing I know that even comes close to say, it says the only step we can practice to perfection is the first step. But I believe to a well-integrated, spiritually profound life, the steps are of equal importance. It's kind of like our triangle. It talks about recovery, unity, and service. It would seem that all three of those are of equal importance to the well-rounded life, but we spend about 90% of our meetings on recovery. So I believe all the steps are of equal importance. But I had a lady ask me, she said, when you look at the 12th step, what's the most grabbing word in that step for you? What word do you think makes that step go? And I guess every word in there, but the word that she said, the word that makes the 12th step go is the word the. And I said, well, where do you get that? She said, well, the word the explains where a spiritual awakening comes from. It's the result of the first 11 steps. You don't have to do anything to get a spiritual awakening other than we like to call practice, the first 11 steps as a way of life, a spiritual awakening moves in on its own. So, you know, in carrying this message, I've had wonderful things happen. I've had the ability to participate in people's lives and enter their lives in a profound way. And not only has this given me a way out of the valley, it's given me a way to reach my hand out to the fellow man. It's given me a way to stand the test of time. I've raised my kids here. They're grown women. They've never seen me drink. They're going to be 26 and 27 years old this summer. You know, I got son-in-law now. I got a grandchild. I got a wife who supports what I'm doing here this weekend. I've got a job. I went to North Carolina in 89 on a job. I'm still on that job. You know, I've grown up here. I've learned how to live here. I've been in the bottom of the valley here, and I've been in the top of the mountain here. I've been in such deep distress here that I didn't know if I'd make it through the night. And what I learned by that is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous is slightly more than whatever the problem is. I want to finish up on this thought. I'll let you out of the last hour. I've had two times in my sobriety. The reason I think it's important to say this, there may be somebody in here that's experienced. I've had two times in my sobriety, at 8 years and at 19 and a half years, where I was in such deep distress that I felt like I was being choked spiritually. Bill Wilson called the dark night of the soul. And again, pain is hard to capture. But the only way I can talk about it is that the best I can remember it and the best I can capture it, it made being homeless seem like kid stuff. It felt like I was being strangled spiritually. And, you know, when I came through, I guess I've had three major surrenders in my life and many smaller surrenders, but I think the three major surrenders have been that when I died to my alcoholism on the street at 8 years and at 19 and a half years. That 8 year thing and that 19 and a half year thing, both of those periods lasted between 6 months and a year. And the pain was so incredible, I just felt like I was just being choked off. Well, when the way began to clear out of that is life started to get a lot easier. You know, I don't think we're supposed to be running uphill every day. I think on a good day that, you know, I'm just walking around. I mean, I'm not even aware of any problems. I'm just operating. But there's been times here when I've been in such deep spiritual distress that I, you know, I think that what I learned coming out of that is that this thing is quite equal to whatever the problem is. Run over and killed, the same guy was able to stick his hand out to a newcomer. I can't imagine what kind of spiritual distress they've been in, but I've watched people deal with the imminence of their own problems here. Not only have they done that in such a way that they were able to be go right down the road with class and dignity, they cut a path that a no mind like me could follow. So, you know, it would be foolish for me to do anything in life other than what I do, because I found out just exactly what that guy said. My job is to stay here and practice these principles. Everything else will be added to it. I went, to close up on this thought, I was married to the same woman for 17 years and got divorced in 1994. And my sponsor told me, I guess I made some errors right there at the beginning. Then I became pretty responsible after a while. But he said, you really don't even need to look for a wife. One will just automatically appear. Well, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. That first marriage was a 17-year marriage. It never really should have happened. A good friend of mine just told me to quit saying that, strike that. I shouldn't have said that because of the children. But it was really a marriage where a boy met girl on AA campus. The same program saw me through all of that that's kept me right here no matter what the problem's been. So, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being included in your weekend. I want to thank you for my life and for the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for having me here.